It's now fairly obvious that the business world in the 21st century is going to have a very different shape from the one we've been familiar with for the past 50 years. Vast new alignments of political and economic power are taking place. It'll certainly be unfamiliar. It may also be uncomfortable.
Coca-Cola, зарядись музыкой!
For example, a whole global new market of trainee consumers is being born in countries such as Russia. International businesses are still struggling to get to grips with billions of new consumers. Yes, there's a swathe of new middle classes with money to spend, but many of them are still poor in developing countries, which will only eventually be rich. And multinational corporations are beginning to see that poor people are also a huge potential marketplace if they learn how to reach them. In the new global world, a new global marketplace of poor people. From the conventional point of view, the familiar world is turning upside down. The BRICS nations, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, are on the march. Let's go to what used to be the great newspaper Street of Shame, Fleet Street, to hear more about the BRICS thesis from the expert who's become most identified with it, the chief global economist of the powerful international investment bank Goldman Sachs, Jim O'Neill. He looks out over the new world from his office high above the City of London. Let's begin at the beginning. How is the world going to change in the next 50 years?
I think it's potentially going to change dramatically. If other countries allow globalization to help them and the demographics work as the way they seem to, as though they're going to work, before 2050, there will only be two of the current G7 that are part of the G7 in terms of size. That would be the US and Japan.
Okay, I know this is radio, but let's look at this. We have a map of the world here, and now in sort of economic terms, North America is absolutely enormous. Japan is pretty big, if this is done in relative size of economies rather than size of geographies. And then Europe is also pretty big. Those are the main players, the main top table players at the moment.
Yep.
The rest are tiny by comparison, aren't they?
Well, China has just, in the past couple of years, as people probably know, overtaken Italy. And it's, you know, that is nothing compared with what we're about to see unfold over the next 20 plus years. If we're right, there are enormous opportunities in consumer goods industries, particularly in China and India, but also in Russia and Brazil. And many global consumer goods industries will be transformed by this process.
Now, it's easy to get carried away with this 21st century prospect. The BRICS nations themselves still have a vast transformation to undergo if they're to come out on top by 2050. They make up roughly half the world's population, 2.7 billion people. But wealth levels in Brazil and Russia are barely 10% of top countries such as the US and Japan, and India and China are even poorer than that. Is it realistic to suppose that these countries can really pull their people into the club of wealthiest nations by 2050? Here's another renowned global expert.
Actually, I think if there is one thing I disagree with is the 50-year time frame. I do not believe it's going to take 40 years before these economies will have a place in the sun.
The Indian-born management guru C.K. Prahalad, the author of The Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid, an enthusiast for the vast new potential marketplace offered by the poor, does Professor Prahalad think these countries can really create the consumer goods boom predicted by Jim O'Neill?
The growth engines are starting from ground up. It is internal consumption, people getting rich, they want more of everything from shampoos to washing machines to televisions to cell phones.
And that means something for the rest of us. This is a whole new global economic landscape, a new map of the world, isn't it?
Yeah. I think the last time that China and India dominated world trade was in 1780s. So it's not clear to me that in the year 2030, India and China will not have a disproportionate amount of world trade and certainly a disproportionate size of local market. And that is all built on the basis of people who are now considered to be poor. I always say, build it for the poor, the rich will come. But can you build it for the poor in the established Western countries? Don't you have to export your manufacturing and then your service centers and then your brain power work to the poor countries with low wage costs simply to have any profit margin at all in this new 6 billion consumer world?
The answer is yes. The only place where you will have to totally break your mental models is by going to these markets. And that is why it is exciting.
But that's not very exciting for the people who are pushed out of jobs in manufacturing, in service industries, in call centers in the West. There's a brutal message underlying your rather benign view of this rich, enriching world.
A $30 DVD player is what we like as consumers. But as managers and employees, we don't like the consequences of wanting a $30 player.
C.K. Prahalad. Back to Jim O'Neill at Goldman Sachs, the father of the BRICS thesis.
Let's have another look at our map. Here we are, 2050. And, oh, yes, it's quite a different shape, isn't it, from the familiar one we have in our heads. Great big America, fairly big Europe, great big Japan. We're talking relativities, of course. Those countries aren't going to shrink. They're going to shrink in economic terms relative to the BRICS newcomers, you argue. So, what, China is absolutely enormous on this map now?
On this map, if we put China physically on it, we wouldn't be able to keep the map up. It would be so heavy.
India close behind it because it's got a similar population or a bigger one by then.
Put the two together, then, you know, the world might tip up on its, this map would tip up on its side and would be sort of sloping down in an Asian direction. And of course, if Russia can do something to control its population dynamics better and allow parts of eastern Russia to grow well, enormous shift of gravity on a map like this to this massive great blob in the middle of the east, because, you know, Russia, of course, borders on with China and India, so you can have enormous shift in the world's relative balance. Absolutely enormous.
A new economic landscape.
Very much a completely different economic landscape than we have today, which brings with it enormous issues about security and politics and the relationship between security councils and global economic and political policy making.
This great upheaval in the world picture we've grown familiar with since World War II is not confined to four great big new countries, of course. It's creating new alliances and new trade routes. Eugen von Keller is head of the Beijing office of the international management consultancy Roland Berger. He's paid to keep a weather eye on such significant developments as the travels of the Chinese president, Hu Jintao.
If you look today into Southeast Asia, you do not see only the Chinese tourists flooding the places. You see as well Chinese investment, not only in the tourist industry buying up hotels and so forth. They buy up as well companies. And it's not only there, it's as well in South America. And I wonder whether the Americans have understood what is happening there. You just have to follow the travel itinerary of Hu Jintao. He was in Chile, he was in Argentina, he was in Brazil. That had a very clear strategy behind it.
Raw materials.
Yes.
We'll invest money in you. We can pay off your debts was the kind of thing he was talking about in Argentina. You supply us with soybeans or in Brazil with iron ore. And I've seen it coming into China and it's awesome, the sight of it coming into the ports.
In the 19th century, we had the great game. This is the new great game and far more stakes are at risk in this game.
But what essentially we're seeing, if you stand back from being in the middle of it, as you are for a moment, is the emergence of a new manufacturing powerhouse for the world.
Of course, that had already happened 10 years, 15 years ago in the clothing sector. At the end, it will be 70% of all exported clothing will come from China. The next step was that China went into the electronic mass product markets. Consumer electronics will, at the end, be in China. There will be other industries which will migrate into China. So, for example, the automotive industry has already started, as well the automotive component industry. So you see there are other industries following up.
So who's going to make what in the West then? Who's going to make what in Europe and the United States?
One should not be too much worried about these mass consumer goods industries moving into China. The issue which worries me personally more is that a lot of research and development is as well moving into China. A lot of services are as well moving into China and into India specifically. So what will happen if China will set the standards at one day for mobile phones. Companies like Siemens, for example, they are already not only manufacturing all their standard phones in China, they have as well put all research and development into China, because the standards will be set there and the consumers will decide on what applications they want to have. The Chinese consumers, not the Germans anymore. So what will be left, your question, what will be left to us? Indeed.
The sobering view from Beijing through the eyes of a German management consultant, Eugen von Keller.
Maybe Germany and France shouldn't produce any cars in the future. Maybe they should all be produced in China and India, and they should move on to different businesses. But have you talked to political leaders about such issues today in those countries? They think you're nuts.
This from the man who first publicised the whole BRICS concept, Jim O'Neill. Then, what should politicians in Europe do to protect their jobs and their industries from the rise of the BRICS?
There's nothing they can do to stop the growth of these countries. What they need to do is open their minds up and open their borders up and share in it and move on to other industries. That's what they're going to have to do whether they like it or not. Or otherwise, the Europe of the future will become a tourist destination for wealthy Chinese and Indians and others, and it won't have anything else going for it other than being some great historic place to visit for a vacation.
Relative decline, the position of certainly Europe and probably America and Japan, the people at the top table at the moment, relative decline is uncomfortable and going to be uncomfortable for us, isn't it?
Seems to me, because the UK's openness and the fact that English appears to be the language of choice in this globalised world, I think the UK is in an actually really relatively healthy position. You know, as an island trading nation, it's been one of our greatest benefits for so long.
You mean we've been in decline for 100 years, do you?
We have been in decline, but in order to survive and prosper in terms of our own wealth per head, I think Britain is responding well to these global challenges. And of course, you can see it in London in particular, not just with financial services, but with many other global services increasingly being dominated here. So I think we are mentally ready for the challenge.
And so what the Americans to learn from us over the next 50 years then?
I think Americans do need to learn from us. A lot of American leaders and people do think that the world ends at Kennedy Airport, and that needs to change.
We have to wonder if the whole Western industrial world is not exactly like these commuters on the New York subway, dozing through the familiar routine of travelling in to work that they still for the moment have.
Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
Listen to a man who's seen something like this happen before through American eyes.
We've been talking globalization. We're using that word for a long time, but it really has been Americanization. And now globalization is going global, truly going global, with the rise of the BRICS and the shift in the distribution of global power.
Clyde Prestowitz is a former trade official under President Reagan 20 years ago, when Japan was the up-and-coming challenge to the West. He now wonders aloud if Americans are in for a serious shock to their national psyche and national fortunes.
There's not going to be any more G8. It's going to be G9 or G10 or G11, I don't know what. But China's going to come into that. India's coming into that. Brazil is coming into that.
The World Bank, the International Monetary Fund?
Sure. The World Bank, International Monetary Fund, all of the voting weights and all these are going to change. And the BRICS, China, Brazil, India, Russia, are going to have more weight. Doesn't mean they're going to be exclusive. Doesn't mean that they're going to dictate things. But we're not going to dictate things. That's going to be the big change. We're not going to dictate things.
That's a very big change for you Americans, isn't it?
It's a huge change. And most Americans haven't realized that this is coming. I think within, 20 years, the dollar will not be the world's money, maybe in less time. I think we're going to see oil being priced in a basket of currencies, yen, euros, pounds maybe, dollars.
Talk about the pure psychology of that for a moment. The dollar, the moving aside of America to let other people come in, not as a political problem, but as a psychological problem for America. It is, isn't it?
Well, it's a challenge. It's really a challenge, yeah. I mean, the thing is, when you speak to an American audience and you talk about the dollar could fall, it doesn't register. The reaction of an American audience is, okay, dollar's up, dollar's down, so what? I live in the U.S., so why do I care? They don't understand the privilege that the U.S. has, that when Americans buy oil, they just print green paper with presidential pictures on it. They don't understand that when Brazilians or Japanese buy oil, they've got a sell Lexuses or coffee or something and earn the dollars and then go buy the oil. So when you explain this to an American audience, it comes as a bit of a shock. You know, and then when you suggest, well, you know, there could come a time when oil could be priced in euros, and we'd have to sell the Europeans something and get euros to buy the oil, you know, this is a big adjustment. So it's very important how that adjustment is handled, that it's handled maturely and properly.
Clyde Prestowitz, a former Reagan administration trade official, author of the recent book about the rise of the new world economy, 3 billion New Capitalists. Where does all this leave Western business? One man who has to steer his huge international advertising and marketing group through stormy global waters is Sir Martin Sorrell, chief executive of WPP. Based in London, WPP has many of the world's biggest corporations as its clients.
What the growth of the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India and China, tells you is that, you know, anybody running a major global business has to think of it almost like a portfolio of investments, placing your bets in those parts of the world where growth is faster and stimulated.
If India and China are on the rise, and other countries as well, they're not just on the rise a bit, they're on the rise in the most enormous way,
yes.
The huge engines of growth in China and India.
Right.
And they, at some stage, looking out towards 2050, are going to want and demand a place at the top table,
right.
Which may mean America moving over or Europe moving over in a very significant way. And that's going to be difficult for American industry mentally, isn't it?
Well, I think it already is. I mean, with the sale of IBM's PC division to Lenovo, with higher domestic appliances expanding, you know, they sponsor the Worcestershire County cricket team, would you believe? Who would have thought the RCA brand would be controlled by a Chinese company?
But those are just raindrops on the windscreen compared with what's going to happen in the future.
Absolutely, absolutely. And if you look back in history, when a country or when a region has seemed to have complete hegemony, political, economic, social, cultural hegemony, and there's been no other countervailing force, somebody or something or some country or some region steps in to fill the vacuum. And I think that country or that region is China and it's Asia. And clearly, we're already seeing a significant shift in wealth to the East, and it's very difficult for us in the West to get our minds around that.
Marx said that capitalism would make the rope to hang itself with, and the investment in China, you see, pressing down on profit margins in Western countries because of the rise of Chinese and Indian manufacturing, means that the West, the established leaders of industry all over the place, have got to rethink how they make their money, haven't they? I mean, it's as basic as that.
The trouble with the Chinese is that they listen. The trouble with the Chinese is that they learn and they adapt very, very quickly. And the way they adapt and the way they change is phenomenal.
And that change is not confined to China. A banner by the side of the road here in Mumbai rather overstates the pride that Indians feel in their new global role. It says India conquers the US without firing a shot. I don't know about conquer, but there'll certainly be serious competition from the BRICS with similar force to the way the rising Japan challenged and shocked America and Europe in the 1980s.
We are looking in Europe to fly over Milan or Rome, Zurich. We are looking at Amsterdam. We are looking at Munich. We are looking at Paris.
Naresh Goyal is the founder of one of India's new private airlines, Jet Airways. He's also one of India's richest men, a living example of how the business world is changing shape as developing countries flex their muscles, even though so many of their citizens are still poor. The rise of Brazil, Russia, India and China means ever more business for him.
Russia, we are looking at different places. We are having plans to fly to India, China. We are looking at flying from India, China, beyond China with our new bilateral to the US and other places.
Let's look at BRICS, this theory of that the world will have a completely different sort of economic and industrial landscape to it by the year 2050. The Goldman Sachs thesis. What does the airline map, if we spread it out in front of us, the airline map in 2050 will show completely different sort of lines on it from the one we see today, won't it?
You're absolutely right, I'll tell you. I see that India,
China are going to be the biggest economies in the world. As far as India is concerned, the traffic will grow. 50 years, I can't really predict. I don't know what's going to happen in 50 years. I can tell you in the next year, 10 years, the traffic will grow at the rate of about 15%, if not more domestic.
And it's growing at 3% or something worldwide all the time. So this is far outstripping the global increase, which is itself year on year pretty impressive.
Absolutely. And the international will grow at the rate of 7 to 8 or 10%.
Look, as I take off, though, from Mumbai or Delhi in a jet on one of your flights, as soon as I'm up in the air, I fly over and look down at the cooking pot fires down below me in the shanty towns. Terrible poverty just down there. Unless that changes, India will not get more prosperous, or much more prosperous than it is now. Prosperity must extend to the poor in India as well, mustn't it?
I must tell you, with the new government we have in place, they came out with a minimum common program. You know, before, the reforms did not take into consideration that the reforms must reach a poor person in a village who doesn't have food, who doesn't have shelter, who doesn't have drinking water. That's a part of the minimum common program. I think everybody is realizing that. And as the economy grows, the GDP grows, I think the people's, the standard of living will improve.
Yes, here where I am now, there's a stinging poignancy about all this talk of Indian economic ascendancy. I'm visiting the makeshift camps along the tarmac road leading to the airport in Mumbai, India's business and mass media capital. These are the people whose cooking pot fires you see from Mr. Goyal's jetliners. Up there, the privileged of India and the world cross the skies. Down here, people such as 18-year-old Rameeb are working for about 75 pence a day, making roads for India's new cars. And she's happy, she says, she'll be able to take the money back to her husband's family farm, 2 days' travel from here, and they'll plant better crops. And there's hope, too, for these children half a world away from Mumbai in the slums in Sao Paulo in Brazil. Their lives could be very different from those of their parents if the BRICS predictions prove correct, that is. As the children sit down to a birthday party, I'm off to visit another room full of hopefuls halfway across this sprawling city. New languages for a new alliance. Here at the China-Brazil Business and Cultural Institute, ambitious young Brazilian lawyers and business graduates are already preparing for a future in which their country's fortunes may be even more tightly tied to China's than they are today. They want to learn the language. The institute's director is Alexandre Xi.
I'll teach the history of China, the philosophy of China, especially Taoism, Buddhism, and Confucianism.
You don't teach Chinese communism.
Pardon?
Do you teach communism or Chinese communism or market socialism to your customers, your Brazilians?
No. We only teach language and also Chinese customer and philosophy.
What do you think we in America and in Europe ought to make of the rise of these new huge economic stars in the world? Ought we to be frightened of it?
I think so.
Be very afraid. A wake-up call to those of us in the West. The competition is going to be relentless. Even for the BRICS themselves, as poorer countries further down the economic food chain learn from them how to claim a piece of the global marketplace. Unless, that is, something goes wrong, as it often does with predictions of this magnitude. Look at the almost daily headlines. Pandemics such as bird flu may throw the global economy into chaos. HIV/AIDS has already sapped the fragile economies of the worst affected countries in Africa. The impact is going to go on for years. oil prices and pipelines are creating international incidents.
11 days after Hurricane Katrina swept through the city, police and troops in New Orleans have...
And nature, too, still has the ability to derail fragile human plans. Many millions of the new BRICS consumers will want hamburgers and pizzas and mouthwash and television sets and automobiles. More stuff. For international investors, a great big opportunity. 3 billion new consumers. For the rest of us, businesses and individuals, worries about where we're going to find the oil, the energy, the raw materials, the food, the land to keep it all going. The economist Jim O'Neill, deviser of the whole BRICS idea, concedes this.
Stories of blackouts around the world and enormous periods of pressure on commodity prices will be particularly prevalent over the next 15 years. And indeed, it might be that some of the security issues actually get escalated because of competing interests in search of energy. And I think that will be a particular challenge, perhaps between the US and China in sensitive areas of the Middle East and Africa and maybe Russia itself. And great diplomacy is going to be needed to manage those challenges.
The next 30 years are the really dramatic ones for change, aren't they?
I think that's right, particularly in terms of some of the negative risks associated in terms of the competing for resources and the changing nature of the way institutions should be run. And if we can sort out those dilemmas, I think if you can look through that and see 2040 onwards, it looks like a wonderfully prosperous world.
Wars, terrorism, epidemics, something often comes along to throw the best laid plans off balance. But there's no doubt that other countries with big and clever populations are certainly on the rise. Just as the end of communism changed the shape of a world we'd been familiar with, so the likely, maybe inevitable, ascent of the BRICS nations will again redraw the map of global power. The history books are full of great big empires that declined, leaving behind wondrous ruins. This time, though, it's different. We live in a global world with global media. When and if the BRICS nations, or something like them, take over on top of the world, it will happen right before our eyes. Hold on tight.